It has many names: Santa Ana, Scirocco, Chinook, and in behold, snow season. Coming unbidden at high noon in summer or in the darkness of a winter's eve. The weather vane trembles and then suddenly pivots to point dead opposite. The white-capped ocean calms, waiting as an oppressive blanket of air moves downslope and spreads over the two cities at the mouth of the river. Winter turns to summer, and summer becomes just a step away from hell's back door. The cooling fog flees seaward, fading like a ghost. Now the heat holds a small section of coastline in a firm grip. Heat and something else, the Chetco effect. Tonight's story, The Last Ride on Number 23, comes to us from across the decades, from a time when Brookings was still young, when a railroad trestle crossed the river, bringing prosperity, wealth, and maybe just a little magic. The pain wasn't getting any better. Abel Barnhill lay in bed, rubbing absently at his left shoulder. It was starting to feel personal. The rheumatism, failing eyesight, and the aches and pains of having had the temerity to be this many years into a seventh decade. And now, this ache in his arm. A silent alarm clock that had awakened him earlier and earlier this week. He wanted to curse the unfairness of it all. "Oh, quit your belly aching," Molly would have said, laughing, and he smiled at that memory, then felt like weeping. Even now, 10 years after her death, and he was still looking across that chasm, a gaping wound that never healed, and now and then his own memory throwing salt into it, making it feel as though it had only just opened, his life now no more than a shadow, lost in the light of her love. He would gladly take the rest of his years in agony if he could hold her hand just one more time, look into her eyes and tell her how much he loved her, hear her laugh. Oh, how he had loved her laughter. He swallowed hard and pushed away from the memory, forcing himself into the present as he rubbed his arm again. "I must have slept wrong," he said, and eased up against the headboard. He sat there for a while in the still quiet that occurs only before the sunrise, the silence broken only by Rufus snoring softly at the foot of the bed. The sun had yet to rise, but there was a dim glow around the corners of the wood stove door. Just enough light to make out the dimensions of his small cabin. Just enough heat to keep the pipes from freezing in the night. It was going to be cold when he got out from under the covers, which he'd do pretty soon. The call of his bladder, and its ally, an addiction to coffee, was a goad he couldn't ignore much longer. And he'd have to take Rufus outside and let him do his thing. That is, if he hadn't already done so in some corner of the cabin. Abel sniffed and decided he was probably good to go. Rufus tried to be a good boy. He really did. But he was too many dog years into his seventh decade as well, and Abel knew that Rufus was coming to the end of the line. "Any day now," thought Abel, "I'll wake up and he'll be cold at the foot of my bed, my boon companion, leaving me behind, having gone someplace I ache to follow. Alone completely now, having opened the door yet again to allow grief expanded accommodations inside his heart." It was too damn hard. Rufus was the only connection he still had to Molly. Again, he pushed his uncomfortable thoughts away, looking instead at the stove, allowing the memory of a different door with that same red glow, thinking about other times and other days, not the dark of night at all. Instead, maybe a fall afternoon, and he in the engineer's seat, basking in the heat coming off the boiler while the train sped through the autumn countryside, the sound of tracks singing his motion back to him, the crisp smell of the air overlaid by the thick black smoke coming out of the stack, and the wind whipping it into ground-hugging contrails, the ocean serene and blue in the distance. As alive as he had ever been, loving what he was doing, and yet still in a hurry to finish it for the day. Not to be done, but simply because he wanted to see her again. To rush home to a love that was like the heat of a different boiler, one that enveloped him as soon as Molly would greet him at the door at day's end, clasping her arms around his neck and the light shining in her eyes as he looked down into them. The first and only love of his life. Rufus moved and whined in his sleep. Abel sighed and got up and threw on a robe. He tossed some kindling and a log into the wood stove, turned the old electric stove on, and put the coffee to boil. He opened the hatch over the dog door and then went in and took a shower. Afterwards, the pain in his arm easing, feeling much better really, he went into the kitchen and poured a cup of coffee. Rufus hadn't gotten up. Abel felt his heart skip a beat and ignored the brief pain that shot down his left arm. "Not today, Rufus," he thought. "Please, not today." And knew that was a plea he would make every day. Had been making every day for some time. Someday, all too soon, it would go unanswered. But to his relief, Rufus looked up at him as Abel came to the room, and he sat down next to him on the bed. He cradled the old dog's head into his lap and frowned as he looked at the gray in the fur his hand was stroking. When did that happen, he wondered. One day Rufus had been a puppy, Molly holding him, eyes shining, and then today. Rufus old and hardly moving. Molly long gone. Soon, thought Abel. Soon, memory is all I'll have left. It's okay, my friend, he said to Rufus, still petting him. I'll bring in some hay and you can do what you need to inside. It's too damn cold out there and it's just the two of us anyway. Besides, I'd never tell. Rufus licked his hand and then looked up at him. And as much as Abel wanted to, he would not break that gaze. Rufus wouldn't take his breakfast, but accepted Abel's share of the bacon. He'd gotten off the bed and actually gone out the door for a few minutes. Abel watched him from a window, ready to bring him in. But he managed on his own, and when he came in, Abel brought him to sit by the fire. He wasn't in pain, at least no more so than any old dog. No more than I am, thought Abel. Had it been otherwise, he would have gently loaded him up in the old chivy and driven him down to Doc Harlow's. Rufus was his friend, and that was a friend's duty. But if he was going to pass, Abel would prefer to be in the home he had always known, the home that he and Molly had brought him into. So he sat there with him through the morning, until about noon, when suddenly the cold of winter stepped back, and heat came rolling down the mountainside. Abel damped the stove down, marveling at how quickly the weather could change here. The fog had blown back out to sea, and he decided a short sleeve would do today for whatever chores he might find outside. Make work, actually, but it kept him busy. Busy and away from his thoughts. Maybe even tired enough to go to bed and fall asleep, instead of lying there, eyes wide in the dark. Different times and old memories playing in the cinema of his mind. Rufus had gone to his bowl and actually eaten about half of his food. He looked up at Abel and wagged his tail and looked at the door. A walk, partner? You sure you feel up to it? Rufus's tail wagged faster, understanding quite well what the word walk meant. All right, then, said Abel. Let's do a perimeter check. Could be we've been attacked in the night by the Russian army. Rufus turned his head in that quizzical fashion only a dog can do. What? Said Abel, smiling. It could happen. Rufus thumped his tail against the wall. It was definitely warmer outside than it had any right to be this time of year. Abel looked at the fog bank just off the coast and then down the Chetco flowing out to the ocean. He rubbed a hand across his chin, gauging the weather. Ruf, old buddy, better enjoy today. This is going to be a short one. But Rufus was already ahead of him, walking along the fence line, marking here and there, just in case the Russian army had, in fact, shown up. One sniff and they'd turn tail and run. The 10 acres and cabin that comprised Abel's holdings was unusual in that it was mostly flat. A natural bench on the hillside that overlooked the river, as well as both towns on either side of it. He and Rufus made their way to the east end of the property, and the one place that had a steep rise. Both of them panting, and the pain shooting up Abel's arm, they made their way to a small flat overlook that gave the best view from the property. There was a flat boulder that Abel had rarely used as a younger man, and now took advantage of every time he still managed to make it up this far. He sat down on the soft grass and leaned against the rock, breathing hard. Rufus came over and plopped down with a grunt and put his head in Abel's lap for a serious petting, which Abel proceeded to administer. With his other hand, he took out his handkerchief and wiped away the sweat as he looked down at the vista below him. As always, his mind supplied a long wooden train trestle going across the mouth of the river, a time long past and as solid a memory as a photograph. As he sat there, he remembered that one day. It had been an autumn day, and his mind traveled back to it as easily as a train crossing that trestle. The spur ran off the main track, following it briefly and then turning east between two low hills. Anyone looking from the river would have thought it was headed catty-corner to the other track down to the California border. But instead, it looped back and came out on the south bank of the Chetco. From there, it followed the river for many miles before heading south again to the new lumber camp. Abel liked it, not just for the change of scenery from the track down to Crescent City, though that was nothing to sneeze at, but because it suggested that maybe there was a future for him as an engineer on this train, that with this new stand of timber, the mill would keep on processing lumber, and he would continue to ride old number 23. Things would slow down once winter hit, for sure. But that wasn't unusual, and something most people put money away for. Eventually, the mill would run down its log deck, and then they'd go to one shift instead of two, and then the layoffs would begin. It was the way it had always been. Timber work was dangerous and unforgiving, and he relished that his job was secure as long as there were trees to be harvested and track to follow. There was even talk that the new spur would eventually go as far as Grants Pass, that the mill could diversify with passenger traffic. Still, it was only talk, and Abel did his best not to get his hopes up. Old 23 was a little sluggish today, but that was to be expected. He had 60-plus cars beside the tender, and they were loaded with fir as high as it would stack, though many of the cars have simply one tree, massive enough, it seemed, to build an entire house. He wasn't happy about this heavy of a load, and he had argued with the foreman, but he knew it was a lost cause. "Look, Abel," said Lance, the crew boss, "you know as well as I do that winter's coming up. They're pushing me at the mill to get as much of this wood out of here as possible before the rains come. It's not my decision." Abel knew that to be true, but it didn't make him any happier. "Yeah, and if I blow the boiler trying to make all the grades back to the mill, where's their precious wood going to then?" "Abel, you're preaching to the choir. Take it up with the owners is all I can tell you. I got my orders. Are you telling me you won't take the extra?" Abel grimaced and shook his head. "You know I can't, Lance. It'd be my job." "Exactly," he responded, "and it'd be mine, too. I'm sorry, Abel, I really am. But we're all working our tails off here, and I've got other things to see to." He clapped Abel on the shoulder and walked away. Abel wanted to argue, but he knew Lance was right. Still, it angered him, and he was in a bad mood by the time he finally pulled away, the last car fully loaded. It didn't help that it was hotter than blazes. The weather had shifted right about noon, and he had started shucking his cold weather gear until he was down to work pants and a t-shirt. Throw the heat of the boiler into the mix, and he was sweating tracks through the wood dust and soot that always covered his face by the end of the day. He wiped a hand across his brow, more to keep the stinging sweat out of his eyes than an attempt to dry his forehead. That was a losing battle. The lay of the tracks kept things mostly level, but there were grades here and there, and she slowed down and really struggled. He gritted his teeth at that, but kept the throttle up. Lester, his fireman, kept a close eye on the gauges and stoked the boiler. He exchanged glances with Abel, and they both shook their heads. Abel shrugged and gave it a little more throttle. The last part of the ride was 3 miles of gentle downslope, and if you weren't careful, it could really get moving. This was the most dangerous part of the run, and he had to throttle it just right, especially with this damn load. There was a fair bend on the south end of the trestle, not a problem coming from the south tracks or with a smaller load, but this route was different. Hit the bend too quick, and the whole shebang would tilt, tip, and then fly off the trestle to become a multi-ton missile. Like as not, it would explode on impact, and one Abel Barnhill would make his maker in the form of atoms. But that wasn't the real problem. Whoever designed the spur had either been limited by terrain or didn't know what he was doing. Abel wasn't of opinion that it was the latter, though in truth, it was due to the terrain. Because of the bend in the river, and the way the track curved between two hills before coming out of the main track, Abel had to do it all by intuition and experience. The trestle would not come into view until 2 minutes before he was going to cross it. But that wasn't on his mind as he crossed over the small trestle above Jordan Creek and started up the last rise before heading down to the main line. No, as usual, it was Molly, and now that it was a later day than usual, he was anxious to get home. Concentrating as he was on managing the heavy load, he didn't see the smoke that was rising up from behind the hills by the river, nor did Lester. "Stoke it up, boss," Lester yelled over the noise of the boiler. "Yeah," responded Abel, "we're going to need it. Just be ready to bleed it off when we make the switch over to the main line." Lester nodded and started throwing more logs into the fire chamber, watching the gauges as the heat began to come up. He was as experienced at his job as Abel was at guiding the train up and down the grades. He looked at the pressure gauge, concentrating for a moment, and then turned the valve open a bit more. He looked at Abel, and Abel nodded. It wasn't quick, but the engine began to pick up, and Abel kept his hand on the throttle, running it almost by feel. Now was the crucial point. They weren't going that fast, but the downgrade was coming up, and as soon as the middle of the train passed the top, it wouldn't just be the engine pulling them along. Gravity was going to step up in a big way, and that was where the danger was. The first curve, where the spur went back to the main line, wouldn't be an issue. But the one headed into the trestle, that was what concerned him now. Between those two curves, Abel would begin to shed speed, but not too much of it. This was a lot of weight to be running across that trestle. He had to keep it slow enough to make the curve, but fast enough not to be on the trestle any longer than necessary. There would be no dallying on this crossing. The load came up over the grade, and there was a solid thump as the cars all lurched forward. Immediately, the train began to pick up speed. Abel throttled back and let gravity take over and push. The boiler hadn't exploded, and he gave a sigh, but knew that there was still work ahead. It wasn't until they rounded the last hill, with the trestle now coming into sight, that either one of them looked out of the cab. "Oh, dear sweet Jesus!" Lester yelled. "The trestle's on fire!" Abel's head jerked up, and he immediately reached for the brake, and then stopped. This much inertia, at this speed, and they might get stopped somewhere about the middle of the trestle, in the middle of a raging inferno. Instead of the brake, he grabbed the throttle and pushed it forward as far as it would go. Lester jerked his head back up, his mouth in an O of surprise, and then understanding lit his eyes. He stoked the last of the wood in the fire chamber and slammed the door shut. With practiced ease, he valved the boiler to full pressure, and then turned and gave Abel a sickly grin. "Think it'll work?" he barely croaked out. "Don't know, but it's our only chance." Lester nodded. "When do you want me to cut the rest of it loose?" "Go ahead," said Abel. "We'll get ahead of it and hope it doesn't slam into us once we get over the trestle." "Is that going to happen?" Abel clenched his jaw and said nothing. Lester moved back and, with not a little effort, unpinned the tender car. The engine began to pull away from the rest of the train. Ahead, flames shot into the sky, and flaming pieces of trestle began to fall away. On either side of them, the ground rushed past. It had been built up here to meet the trestle, and there were 20 to 30 foot drops on either side, comprised mostly of boulders. Both men knew their only chance would be to outrace the fire and hope they could cross it before the trestle fell in. It was coming up quickly now, though to Abel it felt like it was taking forever. The locomotive was pushing as hard as she ever had, and the rest of the train was now many yards behind them. Lester hung out the window, trying to see through the smoke, but it was thick and heavy and lit with an evil glow. They were going to hit the first curve too fast. Abel could feel it, coming up from the tracks like a messenger of doom. "Hang on!" he yelled, and touched the brakes hard. They were both thrown forward, but managed to stay upright. The wheels screamed in defiance as they locked for a brief moment, and Abel could smell the burning heat of the metal sliding on metal. The locomotive went into the curve, shrieking like a banshee. Abel held to the brake for a split second longer, and then let it up and pushed the throttle hard. The engine surged, and then tilted to the left, the right side coming completely off the track, the trestle shuddering beneath him. Up, up it went, and as Abel looked out the right side, all he could see was sky. His stomach flip-flopped, and he gave the throttle its last. Around the corner they went, air whipping the smoke from the stack back at them, tilting, tilting, feeling like it was going to go over, and then equilibrium. Equilibrium, and then the hand of gravity reached out and took them. The enemy ahead, the savior at the moment. With the sound of 1,000 hammers striking metal, the engine slammed back down onto the tracks, and they leaped forward toward the flames. Like falling into a boiling mass of blackened cotton candy, they entered the smoke. Now both men hung out the windows, peering into the smoke, trying to see if the track would still be there. Their eyes stung, and Lester gave a sudden staccato of coughs and then spit a dark glob. They were flying blind at the devil's own speed. A gust of wind, and for a second the track was clear in front of them. Flames danced 20 feet on either side of them, but the tracks were still there. Lester gave a great shout that abruptly stuck in his throat. In slow motion, not 40 feet in front of them, the tracks suddenly shuddered and then fell away. They were rushing toward a 20-foot gap in the trestle. There are times in everyone's life that your future becomes as clear as spring water. Abel had no idea what Lester was thinking, but he dropped his hand away from the throttle. "Molly," he thought. "Molly, I'm so sorry." Now the gap was just in front of them. Flames lit their faces so that they seemed just a part of the fire, and the thick smoke stung their eyes. The trestle shook beneath them like an earthquake. On the other side of the gap, another section fell into the river far below. Abel stood up straight. "I'll meet my fate like a man," he thought. And instead of the fire, all that was in his mind was his Molly. Of the years they wouldn't have. Of the dreams that were now burning and falling into the abyss. "Molly," he said once more, as the front of the locomotive reached a gap. And that was the moment when time stopped. "No," he heard it as she was standing right beside him. "No," she said again. And this time he could see her, an image wavering against the smoke. He rubbed his eyes, but when he pulled his hands away, she was still there, standing, smiling at him from this strange frozen tableau. The train at the very edge, Lester hanging out the window, his eyes wide and his mouth frozen in a soundless yell, the smoke not moving, and the flames as solid as red ice, and on the other side of the gap, Molly beckoning to him, smiling as she held out her hand. And once more, "No. No, Abel. I don't accept it, and neither should you. Come home to me." She held out both her arms, and the flames of the smoke seemed to travel down them, down toward the trestle, tying in with the rails, and crossing the gap to reach the other side. Flames, frozen as solid as iron from one side to the other. She smiled once and stepped backward into the smoke. The locomotive surged forward, the front wheels on two blazing rails of fire, screaming and turning blood red from the heat, shooting forward, crossing the gap, and racing across the trestle on nothing more solid than love. They shot out of the smoke, and suddenly the other side of the riverbank was racing toward them. Without thinking, Abel grabbed the brake and slammed it forward. He and Lester were both slammed to the floor, and Abel could hear the snap of Lester's arm. His own head banged hard against the boiler, and for half a minute all he could see were stars. The engine crossed the last of the trestle, sliding on locked wheels down the incline on the other side. A group of people that had come to see the flames stood on the sides, mouths agape at the sudden appearance of this iron behemoth from out of the smoke and flames, watching the shrieking giant shoot past them and into safety. Another thunderous crash, and the crowd whipped their heads around once more to gaze back to the river. The remaining south portion of the trestle, trailing flames and smoke, began a slow and majestic crash down into the river. Great gouts of steam flew upward, obscuring the sun and making a false sunset of smoke, flames, and rainbows. Then, continuous cracks of thunder as the rest of the train shot out into space from the edge of the riverbank, jackknifing, logs slamming with a noise that rumbled through the ground, crashing down into the river and forming a false dam of steel and wood, sending out great tidal waves of water to briefly challenge the ocean. Behind the crowd, the locomotive finally came to a stop. Abel sat up and gingerly touched the huge bump on his forehead. His head swam and his mouth felt dry. Sweat covered him, and it took a minute of sitting before he could begin to concentrate. He was shaking as if it were freezing rather than the hell's heat that still washed over him. Lester was flat on his back in the cab, holding his arm and groaning. Abel crawled over to him, fighting the urge to cough from the smoke that was still in the cabin. "The boiler," gasped Lester. "Valve it off." He gave a pained chuckle. "Hate to get killed in a boiler explosion after all of this." Abel spun the valves and then went back to Lester. "I'll get someone to get the doc down here," he said, and started to leave. Lester reached up with his good arm and grabbed Abel by the shoulder. "Did you see it?" he said. "Did you see what happened to those tracks?" Abel sat down hard next to Lester. "Yeah," he said in little more than a whisper. "Yeah, I did." "What was it?" Lester asked. "Dear God, what did we just see?" "I don't know," said Abel. "I just don't know. We should be dead." "Are we?" Lester asked. "Are we?" Abel grinned through his smoke and grime-covered face. "I don't know, Lester, but we've left hell's flames behind us, and truth is, I'd never really expected to see either one of us in heaven." And that's the way the crowd found them when they came up to the cab. Two men, both grimacing through pain, and laughing like they had just cheated death at a game of cards. Sitting here now, on this hillside, his eyes closed in that long-gone memory, Abel remembered that he and Lester, by unspoken agreement, had never talked again of what they had seen, what they had experienced, though they remained good friends for a long time. The burning trestle had been the death knell for the mill. The day that last log came off the log deck was the day the plant closed. Product that would have been shipped by rail was laboriously taken out by ship. Abel took a job on a boat doing commercial fishing, enjoying the gentle rocking and the calm mornings with the sun just coming up, but never having that sense of fulfillment that his job in number 23 had given him. The best of times, he thought. The best of times. The sun felt good on his old bones, sitting here with his back against the boulder. He would have gladly stayed, relaxing in the gentle warmth, but Rufus would be sore from their walk. So, he figured, would he. And with both of them in pain, it would take some time to get back to the cabin. He certainly didn't want to be stumbling around after sunset. He stood and stretched and was surprised to not feel any pain at all. Now, why should that be? He shrugged. Maybe the sun seeping into old bones. Certainly rare, but he wasn't about to complain. Besides, odds were that as soon as the cold came back, so would his aches and pains. He looked down at the river, looking as he always did for a trestle that had once stood there. That, on that long-ago day, he had raced across on flaming rails, made from the love of two people for one another. For that was how he finally settled it into his mind. Not a hallucination, not a false memory, but some kind of magic that still inhabited this earth. A simple refusal that they were not to be parted, that their love would transcend even death. And it had worked for so many years until the cancer had come. And in her eyes, he had seen that he would finally have to let her go. Because that's what friends did. "Come on, Rufus," he said, and then stopped suddenly. A feeling washed over him. That same feeling of that long-ago day when time had frozen. A day when he should have died, but lived instead. A day not unlike today. Because he had been seeing it since he stood up, without really seeing it. The trestle was there, crossing the mouth of the river, outlined by the sunlight glinting off the ocean. Pure and pristine, as though it had just been built. Timber strong and rails shining anew, as if the last spike had been driven just today. I'm dreaming, he thought, and rubbed his eyes. It was still there. And more than that, he felt his heart catch in his throat and he wanted to weep. There was a train down there. A train he would have known anywhere. His train. Number 23 stenciled large and proud on its side. Smoke billowing gently out of the stack. Idling as if waiting for someone to come and push the throttle. Even from here, he could feel a gentle vibration. Rufus, he yelled. Rufus, come here, boy, and... He turned and looked at Rufus, and his knees went weak. There was an old man sitting on the ground, his back against the boulder. He might have been sleeping in the warm heat of the afternoon, save that there was no rise and fall of his chest. An old dog lay next to the old man, his muzzle resting on one of the man's legs, neither of the two of them moving, neither of them breathing. It's me, he realized. It's me and Rufus. Oh God, what is this? He started towards the two bodies but froze in place when he heard a voice behind him. Hello, my love. He whipped around and almost stumbled. Molly, he gasped, and then his knees did fail him, and he sat down abruptly on the sun-warmed ground. She shimmered in front of him, tears making her seem like gossamer. But it was only his tears. She was as real as he as she came to him. The sun shone through her hair, gently touched by a warm breeze. Against that halo, he could just make out her smile. Staring up at her in awe, heart hammering, wanting to believe, but afraid it would all be gone in an instant. Just an old man's hallucination. She knelt down next to him, and then leaned forward and kissed him long and hard, pulling back at last to look at him, her face glowing. I've missed you, old man, she said, laughing gently, and his heart soared at the sound of her laughter. He gazed back at her, at the young woman he had married, now brought back to him. Then it was that the truth of it came to him. Not brought back to him, but he to her. Molly, he wept, and held her to him, breathing in the smell of her, pulling back and taking her face in his hands, looking into eyes that held only love and his reflection, and then holding her to him again as he wept against her, his tears washing away 10 years of an eternity of her absence. They stayed that way for a long time, holding each other, drawing strength from one another, until finally he was calm, wept out but filled with love. She helped him to his feet, and he clasped her to him, his arms young and strong. Not the arms of an old man at all. The arms of a young man who had crossed a burning trestle because of that love. How was all he could get out. She smiled and snuggled her chin into his neck, as she had so many times before. It's love, Abel. That's all it is. It's all you and I ever needed. She pulled back and smiled up at him. Come on, she said, laughing. Let's go. But where, he asked. Why, wherever you want. Wherever both of us ever wanted to go. What about, he asked and pointed to his body and that of Rufus. Oh, that, she said, smiling. That's just an old suit you don't need anymore. It's a dream, he said. It has to be a dream. She laughed again, young and vibrant, a sound that had always been the root of his love for her. Don't be silly, Abel. That was the dream, she said, pointing at his body. It's now that you finally awaken. Rufus, he said, what about... There was a loud bark, and Rufus bounded up to him, putting his paws on Abel's chest and licking his face. Fur glossy and eyes that glowed with life. A young dog, hardly more than a pup, and anxious for them to be on their way. He leaped away, dashing through the brush, following the scent that only a young dog could follow, looking back once and then running down the hillside to lead the way. Down below, the horn from number 23 gave an impatient toot. Clutching Molly close to him, as if he would never let her go, they walked down to the train.
The weather vane turns and a breeze cools the harbor. All is as it should be. Tonight's story, The Last Ride on Number 23, was written, produced, and read by Dan Gray. Music for tonight's episode provided by ZapSlap.com.